music from Rick Barron, Minnesota singer, songwriter, and What God Sees. Before that, we heard Heaven Just a Prayer Away, Dolly Parton and Southern Offerings. At 10 minutes after the hour, we are joined by Dr. Don Clark, biochemist and member of the Board of Creation Moments. Don joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. And Don, good morning. How's the weather treating you? I got to ask, because I know there's been nasty weather through the central part of the country down there. How you doing?
Oh, we're doing fine. We thought we were going to have some thunderstorms yesterday, and it didn't materialize, at least not in our direct area, but Oklahoma certainly.
They got hit, didn't they?
Yeah. They got hit again.
And Arkansas, I understand 16 deaths in Arkansas. And a lot of that's a huge low-pressure area over Nebraska. And it's bringing up moisture from the Gulf up to us. It's raining cats and dogs up here, and 30-mile-an-hour winds and snow in the forecast the next couple of days. So
I can't
tell you how delighted we are.
Yeah,
to hear
it
that,
sounds like it,
Dr. Don.
You can't wait.
Yeah, how the grapes doing? Don raises grapes, Don.
Well, they're recovering. They got frostbite a couple of weeks ago when we had a. One night, I mean, it got down to maybe 33, but the wind was blowing, and so it killed the young shoots that were coming out, so now the vines are struggling to come out again.
Okay, well, they will survive. You'll work them. You'll make something good out of this.
Yep, that's the plan.
Yeah, so. little Cabernet, maybe. Well, not Cabernet.
Well, that's going to be hard, because I don't have that type of grape.
Oh, okay, well, all right.
Except for a Ruby Cabernet, which you can't make a wine by itself because it's kind of vegetative. Okay. So that's the Ruby Cabernet is used to blend with other wines.
Okay.
To give it more color.
Already. Well, it's a color thing then. That beats oxblood. I heard at one time that in Italy, at least the cheaper Italian wines, that was actually an ingredient. Is that true or is that urban legend?
Oxblood. No, I think it was true. Ew. And then they find they had to have some regulations against it.
Yeah, I would hope so. Dr. Don is the only, the one and only resident biochemist here at Broken Road Radio. We typically talk about things scientific. We talk about evolution, and we talk about creation, and we talk about faith and science and issues like that. There was an article last week over at upi.com on pterodactyls, and it had to do with a new find that has revised the thinking of scientists, paleontologists, about this whole kind of critter called a pterodactyl. And this latest one, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Cryptodacron, you'd have to call it. It says a progenitor spread its 4.5-foot wingspan roughly 163 million years ago. Well, Don, how rough is roughly 163 million years?
Well, searching through the article, it's pretty rough.
No.
It looks like the way they date these things, is in what layer of the rock they find them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, they found it in the Jurassic, the mid to upper Jurassic period.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're dating it to that particular age.
Now this was a find from the area of northwest China. It's a desert area, and it says that area is a treasure trove of late Jurassic fossils. So this would have been a fossil. They named it Cryptodacron or Cryptodrakon. I'm not sure how they would pronounce it. It means hidden dragon. It says kind of a tribute to the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon here, which was filmed near there, by the way. The bones of the ancient bird were originally misidentified, weren't figured as evidence of a new species of pterodactyls until scientists began reassembling the skeleton several years later. So, is this something old that's something new? Is this a huge discovery for them, or is this just a new story?
Well, the discovery is this particular pterodactyl is a little bit larger than the other ones. And so they gave it, they're calling it a different species.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with all of this, they're trying to find, the links between different species and different kinds of animals. And all this is saying is that this one apparently was buried a little bit deeper than some of the other ones. And it's a little bit larger than the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a surprise? Well, for those in this particular work, I suppose it was, because it pushes back the date of when these animals existed. It's not necessarily a surprise for us, because it just means, well, it's in a different layer of mud, and it doesn't, you know, it does. if you believe in a global flood model, and this is where you get the burial of all these animals, is you know, during the flood, or immediately post flood. And so where these animals happen to fall in the, you know, the layers of mud, it determines their age, according to, you know, archaeologists and the folks that are looking at these things. So,
you know, we've examined a number of stories like this in different arenas, different animals, different fossils, different places. But the gist of each story seems to be that science is surprised by what they found and have to revise their earlier thinking. That's the message I get out of this, that what was cut and dried before no longer is cut and dried, and now the boundaries have been pushed back to a different location. They keep revising what they have called a scientific finding. When do we wake up and say, well, maybe that suggests that all these conclusions that we read about are not so certain after all?
Well, it depends on your worldview. I mean, if your worldview is that, well, there was no global flood, and what we're actually looking at is these animals being, you know, buried in different layers over eons of time, then it's hard to interpret it any other way, because you have no other model to look at it. For a creationist, we look at that and we say, well, yeah, okay, a different layer of mud that solidified into rock, and so therefore, is that surprising? Well, no, they. Because the different layers stratified because of different speeds, let's say, of the water that was flowing over them at the time, the different sediment that was in the water, and of course, you know, during the flood there was a tremendous amount of uprising, if you will, of the environment, the whole environment.
Lots of sediment, lots of changes. We've talked about that.
it's kind of surprising that these folks would say, oh, wow, we've got a tremendous new breakthrough here. And these guys are living earlier than we thought they were living.
Well, the credibility of this science, and paleontology in particular, I would think, depends upon the system that they've devised to measure things and to date things. And apparently, and this may be a large question, but in my layman's mind, I don't know how to answer it. They found this critter, this pterodactyl, in a layer that they identify as a Jurassic layer. Which means, because somebody pulls out a book and says, ah, Jurassic, that brings it back to 163 million years. That means somebody at some point in the history of this science, paleontology, decided that deep down in the ground was 163 million years ago. Now, how would they, other than just doing that to expedite analysis, how did they ever date a layer of Earth to that age to begin with? Now, I think the assumption is if it's in that layer, because the chart says 163 million years, that's how old this thing must be. But how did they determine that to begin with?
Well, it could have been, with the radioisotope dating. Now, not your standard carbon-14, because that doesn't get you back that far. But other radioisotopes of the rocks in the various layers. And then looking at the fossils that are in the rocks. Now, it used to be that they would date the rocks by the fossils that were in them, and then date the fossils by the rocks that they found, which is a circular argument, because...
That's what I'm thinking here, yeah.
Yeah, there is no standard. But I think over time, folks have done some radioisotope dating of the rocks, and that's how they got the original, you know, the original time frame and scale. And so they're probably looking in this particular case at what other fossils are in that particular layer and say, well, these are Jurassic fossils. And so that means...
Now, when they say layer, are they talking about depth underground or some other characteristic of the topography?
Well, it could be. It's not only depth. It's the it's the type of fossils that are in that particular layer.
Well, that's what makes it circular then. That suggests that the assumption has been made that those fossils always fall into that category.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And so there's no reinvestigation, if you will, of doing, well, let's mm-hmm. do some radioisotope dating on the particular rock or the sample, for that matter, to find out, you know, how old this is. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if these are fossils or, you know, if they're bones.
Well, of course, this is a UPI article. It's not a scientific article. And they give us links to National Geographic and to the Journal of Current Biology. We can research this thoroughly. But the point is that they've discovered a new pterodactyl fossil that they have named, and it's bigger and older than other pterodactyls, although apparently still from the Jurassic period, which is somewhere around, it says roughly 163 million years ago. And do we have a lot of other fossils? Is that where most of the dinosaurs fall?
In the Jurassic period, mm-hmm. yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, a pterodactyl, I mean, we've always, you've always thought that, well, pterodactyls, you know, lived kind of with the dinosaurs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in actual fact, all these animals kind of lived together. I mean, we talked, you know, the dinosaurs, beast of the field in Genesis, you know, mm-hmm. Genesis 1. So there was... It's interesting because there have they said, you know, the pterodactyls are extinct,
mm-hmm.
but some folks, at least some of the natives in the Congo, have seen creatures like this, you know, deep in the Congo. Now, whether they still exist, I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me if we would find one, because we're not talking about, you know, that far back. If you're talking about paleontological ages, if you will, but young Earth creation ages,
mm-hmm.
The time of the flood being about 4,400 years ago, 4,500 years ago, is not that far back. And some of these creatures certainly survived the global flood. And,
well, that was my next question, because from a creationist position, a strict creationist position, could anything other than Noah and his family have survived, and the animals on board the ark have survived the flood?
Well, of course, all the sea creatures certainly could have survived. Now, you know, whether the birds, of course, we know there was a raven and a pigeon or a dove on mm-hmm. board the ark. And so there probably were other birds as well. They wouldn't have had anything to eat, you know, for a long period of time. And presumably the same thing for a pterodactyl, except that, you know, if it was a scavenger type of animal, that there certainly should have been a lot of dead animals and dead things mm-hmm. once the land started to appear again. Which wasn't all that long, but...
Would a creationist have any problem accepting that animals, dinosaurs, pterodactyls, animals of that type actually existed?
Not at all, because any animal that wouldn't have survived outside the ark was inside the ark. Because God was preserving the different kinds of animals.
Yeah, that's an interest. I'd never heard it put that way. So it sounds like what you're saying is God made the decision that those animals that could not survive would be kept safe in the ark. Other animals that had at least a chance of surviving were left outside the ark, so that Noah then would not have had a mating pair of every species on earth.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Well, and when you say species, I mean, we're talking about kinds.
Well, kind, yeah.
It's been estimated that at that particular time, of course, there were more kinds back then than there are now, but that would have been about 20,000, different types of animals.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of having a wolf and a coyote and a dog, you would have the dog kind, which would have included, ultimately, those would branch off into the different species that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And that would hold true for, the other animals. But there certainly was dinosaurs on the ark. And did they have to be the huge dinosaurs, that we know today? Well, no, they could have been adolescent dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to be quite so big. They certainly would have been on the ark, and I would have presumed if the pterodactyl couldn't have survived that harsh environment, which it would seem, since there's no place to land, they probably wouldn't have survived outside the ark, but they probably mm-hmm. were inside the ark, and then they came through the flood, and then when the animals finally left the ark, everybody left the ark about a year later, then they would have been one of the animals that left as well.
Yeah, the flood would... I'm sorry, go ahead, David.
No, that was just, you just mentioned one of the answers to my question that I thought about but hadn't asked. How long were they on the ark?
Well, it was about a year.
About a
year for the waters to subside. So there was, as I was saying, a lot of geological activity going on at that time. It was probably the time when the continents broke apart. And so you had a lot of volcanic activity as well. And it's in the Bible. It was about it tells you when they went in the ark, and it tells you when they came out of the ark.
Mm.
It tells you when the ark landed, which was about 3 months, I think, after the mm. flood. We know that obviously it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and the waters came up from the deep. The Bible is very descriptive of the events back there. Obviously, God wanted us to not be ignorant of it, to answer questions like this.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Frankly, I mean, it's
yeah, and
it's amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking at the National Geographic article, and then and it's the National Geographic Daily News. It's an article within that, not out of the magazine, and it talks about that it's interesting about this particular creature beforehand was thought to be one that walked around. But now that it's flying, it doesn't necessarily mean that it was always staying there. That it had a range. It flew around and went other places to get food and sustenance and whatever. And, like you just said, there were flying creatures that probably survived a little bit afterwards that ate other dead creatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which there would have been plenty around once the once the land started to dry out and reappear.
Wow. And we're talking about an article over at upi.com from last week that made mention of a 2001 discovery of the oldest pterodactyl species found to date. And they call it the, if I can say this right, Cryptodacron.
Crypto dragon.
Crypto.
Yeah, little
crypto,
bigger.
Crypto dracon.
They need a better namer person, I think. Anyway, 4.5-foot wingspan, roughly 163 million years ago. They dated to, it was found in northwest China. And there'll be a link to this article in our podcast of this morning's conversation with Dr. Don, so you can refer to it if you'd like. And there are comments and there are internal links in the article, so you can really, really get into this if you'd like. But what interests me most, and I'd never heard Don talk about this before, that there were animals outside the ark that would have survived the flood. And for those people who sit on the outside of the creationist model and point at it and ridicule it for being illogical and totally not rational, it is rational. And really, the only thing, Don, the only 2 points I think that an evolutionist, well, let's just say an old earther could quibble about would be the time of the flood and the notion that that every living thing was on the ark, and we're just saying that that's a non-issue now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like I said, the sea animals weren't on the ark because they would have survived.
Needed an aquarium. Yeah.
Yeah, and whether or not other flying animals were outside the ark, obviously, like I said, there were birds that were inside the ark, so it's hard to imagine any animal that would have needed to perch, like a pterodactyl, for example, would have survived outside the ark. So it was probably inside. But the ark was plenty big. I mean, we're talking about a huge. It wasn't. People get a little confused about what the ark actually looked like. It was a long, rectangular, cube type of structure. It wasn't navigating to go anywhere, so all it was designed for was to be a stable vessel in very, very rough seas. And we're talking about major tidal waves and major sea disruption during this period of time. And studies have been done with the description of the ark. The length, width, and height of the ark, and it turns out that's the most stable structure. That not only from the harmonics within, because every structure has a natural harmonic to it, depending on the shape, but the harmonics were designed to not twist and bend to the human harmonic frequency or animal frequencies, which would have made people very, very sick if it was. And so, this wasn't just, God saying, well, let's make this thing, let's say 150 cubits by, whatever.
It wasn't arbitrary at all.
Yeah, it wasn't arbitrary. It was very, very specific, exquisitely designed for the purpose, which was to be a preservative, vessel.
Which says, by the way, an interesting thing about Genesis itself, and the fact is that we're given those numbers. Moses or whoever wrote that portion of Genesis could have just said, and he built an ark. And, who cares about the specifics? But we were given the specifics, I think, for a reason.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we have the engineering capabilities now, in the mathematical models to model the whole thing, and to look at some of these parameters and say, this is there's more to this than just a wooden structure, and the fact that it was covered with pitch, it was inside and out to waterproof it. I mean, who would have thought of that unless God told you at the time. Because there was no boats. There were no boats. There were no sailing vessels of any type. There didn't need to be.
And of course, Noah had a century to build this in, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day because of the Noah movie, which I didn't see.
I think you should. I'd like you to see that and report back. In fact, I have a question regarding that. I'll hold it for just a minute here, though.
Okay. But... anyway, what was Noah doing the 100-plus years that God told him to build the ark, and then he finally finished the ark? he had some sons, and the sons got married. So there were 8 people that entered the ark. But Noah was a prophet, and so he was preaching. He was preaching to the people and saying, look, there's going to be a flood, which they probably, a flood, what does that mean? God's going to destroy the earth, and you better come into the ark. So if that was the case, then there was enough room on the ark to allow other people to come on. If you had that much room for 20,000 plus different kinds of animals, and 8 people, you certainly had enough room for, let's say, 100,000, 5,000 people, perhaps, to come on the ark as well. But people refused. They refused to believe him, and then they mocked and ridiculed him. And God gave them, the point is that God gave them every chance possible to save themselves. Mm-hmm. All they had to do was believe. Now, that sounds like an interesting and parallel story to something else that we have in the Bible, which, of course, is Jesus Christ and what he mm-hmm. what he has done for us. And all we need to do is just believe in the ark, believe in Jesus, and be saved.
It's really amazing how on that level the models throughout the whole Bible, Old Testament to New Testament, are consistent, remarkably consistent, when you draw those pictures for people. You know, this was a type of this, as a type of this, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Now the ark and salvation is a matter that we can relate to in Jesus as well. My question on the movie Noah, and by the way, Noah was a good movie. Don't expect it to follow the Bible, because I mean it's Hollywood, okay? But just in terms of a story and the
it was action packed. It was an action packed movie.
And more than the action, I think it was filmed very interestingly. You know, but they did have the animals in the ark asleep, which solved a problem for me, because I'm thinking about Noah and these eight people. How are they going to clean up after those animals? Who's going to feed them? Who's going to carry water for them? But they solved that in the movie by showing the animals asleep, all of them. Does that ring true for you?
Well, it's certainly possible, and it certainly could have been in a, you know, kind of a hibernation state.
Mm-hmm. That was the implication in the movie, yeah.
Yeah, there was plenty of storage space, so they I'm sure had plenty of food. For the animals.
Yeah, but just think of the types of food
they would have. They had to be at least put into a kind of a docile state, because there was a lot of probably jostling around.
There'd be a lot of natural enemies there, penned up side by side, I would think. Meat eaters in one section and the herbivores in another. I don't know how they would do that unless they were asleep, you know.
Right, right. And, so... The temperament of the animals certainly had to be subdued, and God could have easily have done that, because he called them into the ark. So,
well, yeah, that took something too.
There was obviously some miraculous things taking place, mm-hmm. you know, during this time, and it wasn't all in quote, you know, just natural behavior.
And that's one of the best scenes in the movie too, Don. If you get to see it, is the arrival of the animals and then the snakes and the meat eaters all got first class seats. I'll have you know, the herbivores relegated to the rear of the ark.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know what it was like inside, of course. Maybe we'll find out when we meet Jesus. But
I have a lot of questions for him. That's one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Taking artistic license to describe that, and you know, it's plausible. Mm-hmm. It certainly is.
What if there's a museum?
Well, there's answers in Genesis.
The biggest Smithsonian in the world. I mean, the answers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Oh, and you mean in heaven?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that, what a nice idea, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could take the e-tour and, you know, and understand, you know, was there only one gunman on the grassy knoll? Mm-hmm. You know, and we would learn all kinds of things like that.
You know, could just press the button, a little recording would tell you the actual truth of the matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that idea. A museum in heaven. What a, David! You have a wilder imagination than I ever gave you credit for.
Well, you know, and I just pressed the button in my mind, and the first voice I heard was, "We believe that the researchers have indicated, but they wouldn't do that.
No,
they wouldn't say we believe, and the researchers say, yeah, they would say." This is what really happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is what happened. This is it. And here, you can watch the event, if you will, mm-hmm. in a holographic state. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. completely 3D, and you're immersed in it if you want to.
Well, I would do that. That's been my fantasy. To visit specific events in the world's history, you know, and observe it here. Not like I'd want them to give me a bow and say, go get them. I just want to watch from a distance, you know. I'd like to see. I'm so curious.
Yeah, if there was a place I would like to be, and it was, you know, it is, that's one of those pivotal moments in my own life, is that, mm-hmm. is that, you know, what really went on during the Kennedy assassination, and you know, who were the animals asleep on the ark? Mm-hmm. That's a close second.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are things I like to know. But the other thing I wonder too is that, will curiosity go away when we get to heaven? Will those things, we really won't want to know?
I don't know if I'd want to be alive with no curiosity.
Mm.
Even yeah, if that's, it's that, that's part of our part of our character. I mean, part of the. Mm. I mean, God built that in us. We made in His image.
I think that's part of creativity, and I think that's the part of God we got was creativity, mm. and a sense of wonder. And I hope we don't lose that.
So perhaps God is
talking about movies and talking about this particular subject. If you haven't seen it, it's certainly worth seeing. Heaven is for real.
I saw it Saturday night.
Saturday did you?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, we saw it Saturday night too. Mm-hmm. And so it was an interesting movie, and the book is a short read, and I haven't read it yet. My daughter has read it and recommended.
Yeah, the book should have priority, I would think. The movie to me was okay. To me, it was kind of a soft, fuzzy. The interesting part of the movie to me was how he dealt with his congregation, and with his own feelings about not being able to accept at face value that this young boy, this 4-year-old Colton, the son of the pastor, had actually been to heaven. I wanted to see how he saved that church, and they kind of glossed over that, which I thought was a loss in the movie. But it was an interesting movie, and I did enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't, from a cinematography point of view and from a storytelling and movie, you know, telling, it wasn't as strong a movie as God's Not Dead, which had, I think, probably a greater impact.
But I did not see
it was
that.
It was an interesting movie, and if you can get past the cinema aspects of it. And just look at the content. There were some interesting questions like, gee, the congregation, I mean, he was having a hard time believing. And and then certainly his wife was having a hard time believing and was, you know, being protective mother.
Of course, I don't want to spoil it for folks who are yet to see it, because you got to go with not knowing the whole thing. And I think it's worth the time. It's not a long movie. It's not a great movie. But it's an interesting movie, and I think probably the book would be a good place to end up if you don't start there to begin with, but to include the book in your plans as well. That's that heaven is for real. We're talking with Don Clark, who is a board member with Creation Moments. He's our resident biochemist, and we talk with him just about every Monday at this time about things scientific and sometimes things not so scientific as well, and we just enjoy his company and his insights. And Don, as always, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're quite welcome, and it's been fun as usual.
And one final thing before we go. Mm-hmm. Ox blood used to be used as a fining agent. And what that means is that they would pour dried ox blood onto finished wine after the yeast has done its process, and it would filter the wine, or it would attach itself to the yeast particles and let them sink down to the bottom.
Well, would it have to be listed as an ingredient under current labeling instructions?
No.
No, it wouldn't have
to
be.
No, it wouldn't be. So I mean, it's now illegal.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
Well, that was the ox.
Oh, well, very good. Well, I'm glad you did the research.
Because people get sick from it. That's why it's illegal.
I suppose. And probably the ox lobby had some say in the matter, too.
Whatever disease the ox had could be.
You're going to get it, too. Yeah, the people get sick and die from it, so they stop using it.
That's a good thing.
Don, business.
Don, thanks so much. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
Very good.
Music from the Praise Strings on a Broken Road Radio Monday morning.